summoned through the dimension of sound. People explore the musical world, which they believe to be true. But there is a world, unheard by some, that is filled with stories of an unknown reality, a jazz side.
Happy holidays and welcome to episode 19 of Tales from the Jazz Side with bassist, arranger, composer, producer, Jimmy Haslip. Now, I recorded this episode back in August when I was performing in Long Beach, California. I was playing there with Michael Franks and the band. And how to set this up is a couple of years back when I first launched this podcast, Michael and I were talking about potential guests. And one of his suggestions was try to, you know, see if you can get Jimmy because he would give a really great interview. And I thought, yeah, man, I would love to do that. And Michael helped me. He helped me connect to Jimmy. And when I called Jimmy, Jimmy was kind enough to say, yeah, I'd like to do the show. So that's how the show came about. Now, once I was in L.A. and I talked with Jimmy Haslip, we arranged for a time and a day to do the show. But because his schedule was so busy and I only had a limited amount of time to spend in the L.A. area, we decided, okay, let's record the show after the Michael Franks gig. So Jimmy came with his wife and they saw the show. And then after the show, we all come back to the dressing room and we decide, okay, let's record this podcast. Now, before I go on with this, I have to say this year in particular has provided me with new unimaginable testing grounds for recording this podcast. I mean, if there was a snag, I could hit it, and it was there for me to hit it, I was gonna. I mean, it was a big learning curve. Now, when I recorded this show, I did the one thing that I always decided that I would never do and was also totally terrified to do, and that was to start an interview, get it going, right? And then realize that I had not pressed record. And that's exactly what I did with this interview. But there's no worries about this because Jimmy was nice enough for us to kind of do a little introduction to this again in the little middle part, which I flipped to the front of this. But unfortunately, we did miss the early part of the interview. I didn't record it, so there was no way to have it. So what you'll hear is the continuing of the interview where Jimmy was sharing with us where he grew up and what it was like growing up in the Bronx. Now, over this interview, especially the first part of it, you're going to hear some background noises, and that's the band and the guests and people and the catering that comes in and picks up all the food and plates and the things crashing and laughing and all of that. And that was before you couldn't even hear the interview. And I thought, I'm not going to be able to launch this podcast. But then I thought, wait a minute, let me call Scott Petito. Now, Scott Petito is this great engineer up here in the Catskill areas with the NRS Studios /SP Productions. And actually, Michael has recorded some of his tracks out of Scott Petito's studio. But anyway, I said, let me call Scott. And I called Scott. Scott said, yeah, bring it by. You know, I'll see what I can do. And I said, oh, let's see if we can fix it. Now, also, I wanted to mention that Scott is an amazing bass player too, and he's also agreed to do the show with us in 2016. So that's a really great benefit for us as well, and you'll get to hear him talk about his writing and playing and performing and all. Maybe we might do some engineer stuff, but I'm not sure on that. But in any case, I called him, I went over, and the genius that he is, he was able to clear up enough of the sound in a way that I was able to be able to launch this podcast. So basically, everything that sounds great is Scott's doing, and everything that isn't great is me. So now that I've given you the whole entire setup for this podcast, please enjoy. My guest today on Tales is electric bassist, composer, record producer, and I found out how much of a producer, Mr. Jimmy Haslip. Thank you so much for doing the show today.
My pleasure.
Tonight.
Jake LaMotta lived across the way on the other side of Pelham Parkway. He had a house over there. So I thought that was outrageous because I actually met Jake LaMotta years later.
Wow. The Raging Bull guy.
The Raging Bull guy.
Yes.
So there's all that. And then, of course, I was born in Westchester Square Hospital, and it's still there.
Oh.
I went there about 2 years ago with my brother to see if they had made it into an apartment complex or something.
It's still the Westchester Square Hospital.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Wow. So when you left the Bronx, were you like...
I was still really little.
You were really little. And did you guys move... Did you stay in New York? Did you go like...
My dad got an idea to just get out of town. In the early 50s, early to mid 50s, that's where a lot of gang stuff started happening. Yeah. And so my dad started getting a little nervous about... You know, raising two boys. I have an older brother.
Okay. Just the two of you?
Yeah, it was just the two of us. Mm-hmm. And my older brother was born in Brooklyn.
Brooklyn.
But then my dad got this super duper pad at this apartment projects complex in the Bronx. So they moved everybody over there. And that's when I popped out. And I was what they call a surprise.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because my brother's 11 years older.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you, what's the age difference?
Yeah, he's 11 years older than
me.
Wow,
so that is a big surprise. They're probably like, I'm not.
I don't have a habra.
So, wow.
But I was a really cool tax write-off for my dad because I was born on the last day of 1951. So I was born on December 31st.
Ah, very nice.
So my dad got a tax write-off for that year.
So when you, now, did your brothers play instruments? I know I was reading a little bit where I know your father played, right? Everybody was very musical.
He was an amateur musician. My dad was really a creative person, but because of the times that he grew up in, you know, they had the Depression, they had all this stuff going on, World War II.
Right, yes.
His path went over to when he got out of the Merchant Marines in the 40s, he got a job as a longshoreman, which is a kind of a tough gig.
Right, that is.
In New York City. And then he graduated from that, and he actually joined Customs.
Okay, you mean Customs, the Customs?
Yeah, the U.S. Customs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
He became a U.S. Customs agent. I guess he was in his late 20s, early 30s when he joined that service. So then, and he worked his way up through the ranks. Now, I always remember him in uniform, and then later he started getting up into the upper management of Customs, and he was always in really nice suits, and he actually became the assistant area director of Customs.
Wow.
When he was in his late 50s. Yeah. So I remember all that, but that's where his career went. But really, he had this whole creative side. You know, he was really into painting. And then he played a little piano. He was self-taught. Played guitar.
Oh, okay.
I remember for a while he actually taught me to play ukulele.
Really?
He knew a couple of tunes ukulele, and he taught them to me.
Yeah, do you remember?
I don't remember. I'd have to sit with a ukulele for a while and figure it out, but I hardly remember the tunes. He also played harmonica. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot, yeah.
And of course, my father was half Puerto Rican, and all our relatives were in New York were mostly the Puerto Ricans, and the other part is Dutch.
Oh, okay.
So the Dutch part wasn't around New York. Mm-hmm. It was all the Puerto Rican side of the family. So there was always parties.
Yeah.
And, you know, weddings and stuff with salsa bands.
Yeah, yeah.
So I grew up checking out all that stuff, and then at home... they would play like all these great records by like Celia Cruz and Tito Puente and Mongo Santa Maria and Ray Barreto and Machito and all these incredible records. So I grew up remembering all that kind of music in the house. And my brother became like this real serious kind of jazzbo bohemian kind of dude.
Yeah.
So he'd be in his room listening to John Coltrane and Thelonious Monk and Dave Brubeck and Miles Davis and Eric Dolphy. But then he also loved classical music. So I grew up listening to Debussy and Stravinsky and, you know, Mozart, you know, Prokofiev, incredible music in the house. And then we had an aunt that lived with us. So I actually got a little dose of like Jerry Vale and Johnny Mathis.
Chances are.
Right, all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know. So my house was always filled with music. And then, of course, there was the music of my peers, which was everything from early Elvis Presley, you know, Jailhouse Rock, to like, you know, the Beatles.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And then later Led Zeppelin.
Right, right.
And Hendrix and the Cream.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, yes. I mean, everything, all that stuff. Rolling Stones. So all that music was always around. Plus, I got really heavily into the Motown sound. So, you know, I didn't know I was listening to James Jamerson Sr., but I got really attracted to the bass around that time. But I was listening to the Supremes and the Four Tops and the Temptations and Marvin Gaye and all that stuff. And then I started, you know, from when I was a little kid, my first instrument was trumpet.
Yeah, okay, so, okay. Tuba, you played tuba too.
I played some tuba, yeah. I played a little tuba, a little baritone horn.
Mm-hmm.
I learned how to play the bugle because I was in Boy Scouts.
Okay.
And I joined the Boy Scout Drum and Bugle Corps.
Ah.
So I learned to play the bugle, and I got pretty good at that. So I used to do, I remember this was kind of a special thing that happened every year, and I was in the Boy Scouts for maybe 4 years, from when I was like 7, 8, 9, and 10, something like that.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
And so there was a local American Legion Hall. Do you know what that is? They're veterans of foreign wars.
Yes, exactly. I haven't seen that in, a long time.
Yeah.
Little Rock.
So that's where my Boy Scout troop had meetings,
okay.
American Legion Hall.
Yeah.
So the American Legion guys heard me play bugle, so they would hire me to go out with them every Memorial Day. And I would play taps at like a half dozen cemeteries when they would lay a wreath and then do the 21 gun salute.
Right.
So there was a lot of really cool memories from all that. And then later, these guys I knew wanted to start a band, so they didn't have a bass player.
Okay, and that was when you're around, say.
That's when I was 13.
13. Okay, and you were talking about your father being self-taught. And I was reading briefly where you were taught. It was written that you considered yourself mostly self-taught, basically because you were playing the bass in a different. They were trying to get you to play in using the right-handed method.
Yeah, when I first went to try to get lessons, because at a certain point I realized, you know, self-taught is cool, but I wanted to try to learn more about the instrument, and I had to learn where the notes were, because it's such a different technique than trumpet.
Right, know? Well, yeah, yeah.
It's a whole nother
animal. Breathing and just the lip and all of that.
Yeah, and then now I'm playing with my fingers and getting blisters, and I don't even know where all the notes are. I was just playing by ear.
Oh, okay. So when you started when you were in the band 13, you were playing that by ear at that time?
Completely
ear. Okay, okay.
And I was learning songs by ear, and I would just learn them. Learn a lot of the tunes by the patterns that it would. Because when you look at a neck of a guitar or a bass, it's a grid.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I play the bass a little bit.
Yeah.
Double bass, yeah.
So you know.
They pay me not to play, though.
So I'd see like a, no, that's
yeah, they
not
do.
True.
They do this, here's $20, please
no,
don't
no.
play.
I don't believe that, but that's okay. But I would see like, you know how there's little markers on the on the fretboard,
yeah, the little
right?
Dots.
Little dots.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
So that's, I use the dots as like little signposts. Mm-hmm. And I could figure out where the first note of the song was by that.
Okay.
And then if it was 1-4-5, which I didn't know what that was
right,
then.
Right. But you could hear it.
Yeah, I could hear it. So I knew that I would play, you know, one note, like say on the E string.
Right, 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 right.
Which I didn't know, but it was like an A flat.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And then I knew I had to go to the note above it for the next chord change,
right.
And that was the fourth, but
right.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, right.
So that went up to the D flat.
Right, right.
And then the next note would be a whole step up.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that would be the E flat.
Right, right.
So
yeah.
there's your 1-4-5,
yes.
But I didn't know what that was. I just knew there was that pattern.
Right.
Those three notes.
Yeah.
And I knew a cadence when
right.
I had good times.
Right,
so.
That's important.
Yeah,
that's
especially growing up and listening to Cuban
yeah,
music.
Please, yeah, please, yeah, you know, man, hello. This is true, it's really true. And they're not forgiving. They're not forgiving.
So my time thing was pretty cool. And then, you know, I had been playing trumpet for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So I was hip to forms and all that kind of progressions and things like that. And so I was a very basic, no pun intended, player, but that's how I started off. But at a certain point, I needed to take lessons. So
right,
I would
right.
try to go meet up with a teacher, and they would just try to change what I was doing because
right.
I was playing upside down and backwards. I'm left-handed.
Right.
And when I went into a music shop to get a bass, they were all right-handed basses.
Wow.
So I asked them about a lefty bass, and they actually talked me out of it.
Really?
Said, yeah, it takes too long to make.
Really? How
yeah.
can that take too long to make? I mean, really?
Well, they were just being lazy.
Yeah, yeah.
It was some salesman at Sam Ash,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And me was too lazy. And, you know, and he could see that I was an amateur, novice
right,
dude.
So you wouldn't know. How would you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so he said, just get one of these. It'll be
yeah.
fine. So I ended up buying a little $100 bass or something. My dad bought it for me. And then I learned. That was my first... You know, my first deal with learning to play the bass was just learning songs because
yeah.
I didn't know anything about, you know, the diatonic system
right,
on the instrument.
Yeah, and I always think that having a great ear is so important. It seems
yeah.
to me.
I think that helps.
Yeah.
So I used to sit around and listen to records and listen to the bass part, and I'd learn the bass
wow.
part off the record
wow.
by ear.
That's great. That
yeah.
is really cool. That's really cool.
And eventually I did study for almost a year. I studied with a tuba player.
Oh.
Yeah. And
wait a minute. So you studied with a tuba player.
And he taught me out of trombone books because I could read.
Right. Okay.
So
okay.
he started showing me these exercises in trombone books.
Okay.
And then he taught me the whole diatonic system on the electric bass.
So that's how you learn that.
Yeah, but I had been playing then. At that time, I'd been playing for almost 5 years.
Okay. So I already had some stuff
going on.
Yeah.
But this was like enlightening. I was like, so this is what this, oh, wow. And these are the notes.
Right,
oh,
right.
right so
yeah.
he showed me all that stuff. And he even taught me a little piano.
Oh, okay.
So it was very cool.
Wow.
So I used to sit there with his tuba.
Right.
And I had my electric bass, and we'd play in unison, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was
wow.
awesome.
That is amazing. That's unusual.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody would, you know, say.
No,
so.
It was kind of unusual, but it was definitely enlightening. And
yeah.
it definitely was like, you know, lighting a fuse in me, like to yeah. learn more.
Right, because now when that light bulb goes off and you can now connect what you've been doing for so
it's
long.
Like, wow, okay.
Yeah,
so,
like, wait a minute, there's got to be more, there's more.
There's more. And he said, yeah, there's
yeah.
a lot more.
Wow, that is like so amazing. And tuba, I would have never guessed, I never would have put
well,
the tuba, I mean tuba, of course, it is the bass instrument
yeah,
for
and we're
a
in
band.
The same
yeah,
clef.
Yeah, okay, that's right.
And that's
right.
he would... And he, I think he chose these trombone books because they're very melodic.
Okay.
So I was learning all these very melodic kind of ways of arpeggiating chords.
Yeah. And your playing is just amazing. Absolutely amazing. No, it's just...
It's a work in progress.
Well, no, it's like for me, I think that people can be very technically proficient. You know, they can technically play everything. But it's when that organic
There's comes a bunch
through.
Of that in
here. Yeah, no, it's beautiful. It's so beautiful. That's what the hearts speak to the heart. You know what I mean? That's what I think it's like very powerful. Now, the bass that you play, is it still right-handed bass, upside down, backwards?
Yeah, well, I think it was 1976 is the first time I hooked up with a luthier.
Oh, yes,
and
yes.
He built me an instrument. There's a gentleman named Bernardo Rico, who ended up becoming pretty famous. He was the designer of BC Rich basses.
Oh, okay, yeah, I've heard,
and
yeah.
So I met him way early on before anybody knew about him, through another bass player I met, and he saw that I had something going on, and at the time I was just joining Flora Purim's band.
Oh,
so he thought it was a kind of a cool opportunity to build me a bass and then me go out on the road with his bass, you know. So that's what happened, and I ended up with this really beautiful instrument. So what he had to do was he built a left-handed body, so all the controls are in the right place and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
For a lefty.
Yeah.
But the neck was for a righty. So it was a right-handed neck, so it was upside down.
Oh, okay. Okay, I got it. I got it. Yeah, I was trying to envision, you know.
So that's the... The luthiers go nuts thinking about this.
Oh, really?
But that's what they have to do.
And you know, how many times have you had to have a bass repaired where you...
I've had it repaired a few times here and there, and guys would look at it and scratch their heads, and then I would explain what it is, and then they'd be fine. And sometimes it would be something simple like a potentiometer being all screwed up, so they just had to replace that. And that's a no-brainer.
Right.
But if they had to do a neck adjustment.
And
then change the strings.
They were like, wait a minute, now this
way. The string goes right there. Where?
Right.
So they
no, that's great.
Okay, turns their head up all inside out.
So there's a, you know, we could be talking like so many different things because I have a million questions to ask you, but I'm going to, you know, I don't want to tire
you
out. You
can ask me
anything
you want.
Now, when you work on a project, right? Do you work on one project in a year, or do you have several projects going on, or do you?
I have quite a few going on.
Yeah, because I was curious.
So,
because I'm leading into like what are you working on now? I mean, is there something?
I've always had multiple things going on, especially like when I was in the Yellow Jackets. You know, there was always a project with the Jackets. Sometimes there was even an outside project with the Jackets.
Okay.
You know, like, you know, the Jackets co-produced a record for Michael 1 year.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I remember. Yes.
Yeah, Dragonfly Summer.
Yeah, that's the tour I started on. I started on the Dragonfly Summer tour. Yeah.
So we were in the studio with him in Woodstock.
Beautiful album.
But we had also just finished a record, I think it was called Politics.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, those were two, like, pretty intense projects for us. But then there were other things that happened in the course of the year, other recordings. I was doing sessions as well. So there was always a lot going on. And it's always been that way for me, you know.
Even now, right now, are you working on more than just one project? You're working on
Let's see. When January rolled around this year, for example, I knew I had to go to Indonesia in January, and I was going to record 2 days in Los Angeles with an Indonesian artist, with two Indonesian guitar players. The Indonesian artist's keyboard player named Dwiki Darmawan, and he was bringing these two famous Indonesian guitarists in on the project. There was Topati Hutomo, and Dewa Bujana, okay? So those three guys, they were Indonesian, and Dwiki had written all the music. and they hired me and Chad Wackerman to be the rhythm section. Yeah. And I got Jeff Lorber to be the engineer, and we used his studio.
Wow.
So I brought that element in to help the project out. You know? So we recorded for 2 days and made this really beautiful record called Life, Love, Passion.
Wow.
And then, like, they mixed it and got it all done. And then 2 weeks later, they flew me and Chad to Jakarta.
I spent a lot of time in Jakarta.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we did a tour there.
Wow.
In Jakarta, we were in Bandung.
Yeah,
And we were in Surabaya. Mm-hmm. And we went to Bali.
Yes, Bali is beautiful. Right?
So we did 4 shows, and it was like basically to promote this new record.
Wow, yeah. I didn't know that.
So that happened in January.
Wow.
That was kind of the first thing, you know, project-wise that I got involved in, although I did a week's tour in January with Alan Halsworth and Virgil Donati.
Wow.
So there was a trio, just a little tour, and it was all California dates.
Okay.
So there was rehearsal and tour of that, and then there was the
bang
the
studio thing there, and then the tour around 900 hours of flight.
And then when I came back, I started producing a singer named Marilyn Scott. And
okay,
she was doing it was my 7th production for her.
Wow.
So we did a record of it's all standards from the Ellington era.
Okay.
But we contemporized everything. You know, Marilyn didn't have this in her head, but in my head, as the producer, I kept thinking of how Joni Mitchell might do standards. So I hired Mike Landau, who's James Taylor's guitar player, and he also played with Joni.
Right.
Russell Ferrante, who played with Joni Mitchell.
That's right.
And then we got Gary Novak to play drums.
Okay.
And I got Bob Minster to do a horn chart on one tune, and I got the Perry Sisters on another tune to sing backgrounds.
Wow. Yeah.
So that record is basically in the can, and we're trying to find a home for it, or might be independently released later this year.
Yeah. So that's new. That's a new one. That you
And that was all in February, and I did a little work on it in May.
Wow.
So, but then in February, I also did some sessions for a couple of records. I did this trio record with the guitar player Topati Hutomo with Chad.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just guitar trio. But then I got a call from this singer from Istanbul, Turkey, who I had already produced 2 records for. And she wanted me to produce another 2 records for simultaneously, one in English, one in Turkish.
Right.
The Turkish one was all Turkish folk songs that she wanted to contemporize, and in the English record were all these American pop songs that she wanted to contemporize. So I hired Scott Kinsey from Tribal Tech to do all the arrangements, and I got Gary Novak to play drums, and this percussionist who is half Turkish, half Armenian, played with Zawinul Syndicate named Arto Tunspayatsian.
Okay.
Bad dude.
I remember, that's like, it's amazing.
So I got the 4 of us in the studio, and we cut all the tracks, and then I added guys like Mike Miller on guitar, Larry Kuntz, you know, a bunch of I got this great pedal steel player that I use named Doug Livingston.
Yeah.
He played on some stuff. And also, I forgot, but in January, I finished mixing a record that I started the year before, and that was this record for this German composer from Bremen, Germany, named Michael Schmidt, and he wrote all the music, and I did it with engineer Rich Breen, and I had to use 26 musicians.
Wow.
So I did a tune, I produced a tune with the group Metro, which has Chuck Loeb and Mitch Foreman, and a drummer from Germany named Wolfgang Hoffner, and their new bass player, who's named Nicholas Fitzman.
Okay.
They did a track, and then I did all the other tracks with Vinnie Colaiuta.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And also with Virgil Donati on drums. And then Mitch Foreman played on most all of that. And then there's a a long list.
Yeah, because you were talking about 26.
Were 26 musicians.
Were they American or were they German?
Mostly all American. There was the German drummer mm-hmm. from Metro, German trumpet player by the name of Till Brunner.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's some other ethnic kind of quality.
Right,
Luis Conte played percussion
right.
on some stuff. But mostly American guys. You know, the Fowler brothers were in there. Bruce Fowler, Walt Fowler, Brandon Fields, Bob mm-hmm. Franceschini, Bob Mincer, Eric Marienthal.
Right.
Charlie Bisharat, who's this really beautiful violinist, who's on the record. Also, Scott Kinsey. I got Jeff Thorber playing on some stuff. Steve Weingart.
Okay.
So the list goes on and on. If you want to look at it, I put it on my homepage on my Facebook page.
Oh, okay. I'll check it out. I'm definitely going to check it out. Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I finished mixing that in January.
This is back to back. That's what I'm saying.
That's all in there. And then March and April, I did the two records for the Turkish singer.
Okay,
so that's right. Two months of that.
Right.
Because it was 26 tunes.
Because you're doing two albums.
Two albums. One album had 12 tunes, the other album had 14.
Okay, yeah.
I did them all at the same time.
Oh, wow.
So that I was doing all that. But in the meantime, I finished Marilyn's records.
Okay.
And then I was called in to do, Jeff was producing this singer named Carol Dubach, so I went in and played on her record. And then at the same time, I was co-producing the new Jeff Lorber Fusion record.
So I was doing that with
Jeff, because Jeff and I had some touring stuff.
Right.
And I was doing these productions, and he was doing productions. So in between all that, we were writing tunes together. I wrote five tunes with Jeff.
I'm trying to keep track.
And we finished. It's hard to keep track.
Now we go back to, now we're in March. No, we're
And also in the meantime, some things that I did the year prior now come out. So there's other things that have come out. So it's even confusing to me. that record's out now.
Right, because it's like you
Yeah, there's this Danish guitar player named Soren, I believe. My Danish is not good, but because it's got one of those O's with
the bling on it. Yeah.
But it's Soren Reef,
okay.
And so he's a Danish guitarist, and I had done his record a year or so back with Gary Novak.
Oh, okay, the drummer.
And that's out now.
Now.
And then also I had done sessions for a record by a Danish drummer. By the name of Henrik Enquist, and that was with Osnoy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I played bass, and Gary Novak.
Oh, yeah, Gary's man.
And another guitar player named Jeff Richmond.
Okay.
So that just came out. And then I also did, Jeff and I produced a singer from Norway named Teresa Ulvan.
Okay.
And Jeff and I did that at his studio. That also came out in January.
Okay.
We had done that just at the end of 2014.
Okay. So that time period.
So all that came out. And actually, we had gone to Norway and did a little tour with her to kind of start things rolling.
Right.
So that came out. And then there was a few other things that came out. So as you see, I was doing like sessions for things, and then those things would come out, and then so all that happened. So then in April, I was scheduled to produce a guitarist named Randy Burnson,
okay.
who used to play in Zonal Syndicate.
Right.
He grew up with Jocko.
Yeah.
And of course, Jocko was my teacher for on and off for a year.
Wow.
And then later I ended up playing on two tribute records that came out on Heads Up.
Yeah.
And that's where I really got close with Randy Burnson. And then Randy called me at the beginning of this year to produce his record.
Okay.
So I organized some sessions with Peter Erskine.
Yeah.
And with Gary Novak, with Scott Kinsey, Othello Molyneux, and Bobby Thomas, who played percussion with Weather Report, and Steve Taglioni on saxophone. So that record's done, and it's hopefully coming out this fall. Okay. It's called Grace Notes.
Grace Notes, okay.
So I produced that with Randy. And at the same time, I produced a record by this guy named Jeff Richmond, who's a local L.A. guitar player, and that record has Vinnie Colaiuta.
Okay.
But I cut two tracks. They were really a lot of fun with Gary Novak, Anthony Jackson, and Mike Stern.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
With Jeff Richmond on guitar.
Okay. So
that record's out. That's called Hotwire.
Hotwire. Okay, okay. And that's...
That's out now.
Yeah. I'm going to have to, like, I get transcriptions of this interview so that I can make sure I outline it properly in the bio.
It's
a lot of stuff. And it's...
There's more, too, that I you know, it's
just all in... Yeah, well, people go to your website. They'll be able to see all that.
Yeah.
Now, with all of that you do, how is that set up? Is it because like you were saying, you connected with a friend, and from that person, you kind of, because you work a lot, you produce a lot. Is that because of the networking and the different projects that you do?
Yeah.
That connect?
I've now produced over 100 records.
Wow.
So I have kind of a way of doing. I'm also very open to ideas and the artist's direction and their passion. So I don't try to push things on people, but I have ideas and all sorts of stuff. Yeah. So I have a lot of ideas and things which I gently bring on into the picture, and then we discuss things. And sometimes we use things I come up with, but I'm most interested in the direction of the artist or the band.
Okay. Okay. You know? Yeah. So it's a support network that enhances what they're doing.
Yeah. So if I have a band, for example, that has tunes and they're all good tunes and they play the tunes, then all I want to do with that, because the work's already done, the band's there. They got a sound.
So
they got nice tunes.
Right.
So my job then is to make sure it's all recorded well.
Right. Right.
So I want to hire a really good engineer.
Yes.
And then what I want to do is maybe find little things I can add to the tunes that they maybe didn't think about that will help the tunes in some way, in my opinion. And 9 times out of 10, I'm pretty right on with stuff like
that. Wow.
And there's no ego involved, because if I try to do something and it doesn't work, then I'm ready to throw it into the garbage can. There's no ego about me implementing my stuff.
When you go in and you produce, you know, there isn't this ego involved. You really are open to what that band is, the potential of that band, and
the artist.
Exactly. And that's, I think that's very important for a producer.
Yeah.
I don't think it's found anymore.
No, hardly. and in that sense, you find the uniqueness in the project. You know, because everyone has a unique personality. So that's what I'm looking for. And then once I see what that is, I support that and try to maybe find some things that'll help that.
Yeah, yeah. And it's great. I mean, the stuff that I've heard is amazing. Now is the time, because they're throwing us all out. I got 3 questions I ask, and I always say it's going down into the basement. Now, out of any medium, like whether it's a painting, a photograph, a book, a movie, or just life itself, what would you consider as the scariest subjects, the scariest thing that you encountered in that? I mean, some people have scary, you know, photographs or books, or they read or see a movie that scares them, or sometimes people comment on, you know, nuclear weapons or whatever. So is there anything like that that scares you?
Not too many things scare me, but I'm a little afraid of heights. You know, I always remember my dad taking me up to the top of the Empire State Building and feeling pretty freaked out about
it. Your stomach flipping.
Yeah, and also, you know, I've been in some other situations where I was in, like, really high places, unsupported, you know.
Okay.
And that's, really scary. I also had the honor of going up twice to the top of the World Trade Center.
Oh, wow.
Because my dad's office used to be in there.
Oh, wow.
It was in the, more in the ground floor, mm-hmm. but he took me up the elevator to the top.
Wow.
It was at the 128th
yeah,
floor.
Yeah, that's intense, too, and you can feel the building swaying.
Yeah, and in fact, I think my wife and daughter and I went to see this great movie, Man on Wire.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
This famous story yeah, where a yeah. guy tightroped across
yeah,
the two
which
towers.
Is- Can you imagine?
Freaky. That freaked me out just watching it, you know?
Like, I don't think I would ever do that.
No. Even laid down on the little wire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Incredible. No. And then, you know, things like that. But, you know, other than that, you know, maybe that there might have been some times where I felt maybe underprepared to perform some music and I was really nervous and maybe even scared, you know, on some level to play. But, you know, you find something inside of you to give you strength and push forward and things
you,
usually
you
turn out okay.
Yeah. Well, that kind of moves us into the thing is, your second question is, tell us about someone you have worked with who is a little frightening in a good way, you know, like a little
yeah.
intimidated, frightening, mm-hmm. but in a good way.
Well, it's several people that I worked with. I remember working with Donald Fagen the first time, and I don't know that I was afraid, but I was just uncertain of, you know, what I was doing. You know, he had a way of communicating where it wasn't totally open to, like, what exactly he was looking for. I mean, sometimes he wasn't even sure and was leaving it up to you
right.
to interpret his music, you know.
Yeah.
And then he would judge whether it was
right.
what he was looking for
yeah.
or how if it felt right. So it was an interesting learning experience working with him. And I worked with him on quite a few sessions.
Yeah, because he seems kind of like very specific, right?
He's
very
specific.
Kind of
a lot of times very specific. Mm-hmm. And then there would be times where he wasn't specific.
Oh,
like I remember working on a tune that seemed to be specific.
Yeah.
and it was for a movie called Bright Lights, Big City.
Oh, yeah.
It was a song
yeah.
called Century's End.
Yeah.
So I worked on that tune.
It's great. That's a great tune.
That's a fun tune.
Great tune, yeah.
But it took me a long time to get something that he was happy with.
Right.
And so for a while there, I was really kind of insecure about what I was doing. Like, well, what am I doing wrong?
Yeah,
he's not
yeah.
digging what I'm doing. And I really want to, you know, right. I hear the tune. I hear kind of where it's going and what it's kind of a shuffly kind of thing. But, and I guess he had confidence that I would eventually get that. But,
wanted to make sure.
yeah, but he was very quiet about it. But eventually, I got something that I could see he was happy with.
Okay,
and it was also difficult too because when I went in to do the session, it was just me and him and an engineer.
Wow.
And all they had on tape was a drum set with hi-hat, snare, and kick. And a Fender Rhodes playing the chords.
Wow.
So there was no vocals.
Yeah, so I was like, what?
I didn't.
What?
And I had a chart with a specific bass line,
right.
which I scoped out immediately when right. I got to the session, and I could see what it was. And in fact, actually, I remember also he had sent me a rough chart of it ahead of time, so I even had a little time to scope it out before I got to the session.
Okay, that's good.
Which, yeah, that's
that
always good.
That helps a lot, man, right?
That's a confidence builder. But then it took a long time to get, like, I was playing the notes that were there, but he was looking for something more
mm-hmm.
than just playing those notes.
Mm-hmm.
And I understood that, but I just couldn't figure out exactly what he was looking
yeah,
for.
Yeah, yeah.
But I kept trying different things, and eventually, I think he was happy.
Right,
so
right.
I walked out of there with my head spinning a
yeah.
little bit,
right.
but I also felt pretty happy that I made him happy. And of course, You never know until the record comes
out. Yeah, what they were thinking.
And Steely Dan was always notorious for having many different musicians play on the same song.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So I didn't know what my fate was going to be, but I was certainly very excited when I heard the tune. I think it was on the radio, and I knew that that was me.
That was me on the tune.
And then later, there was even a cherry on top. I found out that the song was put onto a record called Steely Dan Gold.
Oh, wow. So that's right. Like, on one of their hits, the greatest hits. Yes. Oh, my goodness. That's great. The fear paid off.
It did.
Okay, so
there was another guy named Bobby Caldwell that I did some recordings with, and he was pretty intense about what he wanted. Now, he was very specific.
Okay.
So specific that sometimes I was hard for me to even duplicate what he wanted.
Right.
So it was a tough session always with him, but I knew that he was very creative, and I knew that he really understood what the bass was supposed to do in the tune.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew I always felt pretty much under the gun and under the microscope doing those sessions, but the finished product was always very rewarding.
Yeah.
And it's sessions like that where it's a lot more work and maybe even some frustration, and also like a lot of some stress.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
But when you come out the other side with something really solid and good work, it pays off.
Yeah. Wow.
And the only other guy would be Gino Vannelli.
Gino.
I did five records with, and he was also very specific and really tough, and was always trying different things. So it was difficult, but you knew that he really understood what he was looking for.
Yeah.
And there was going to be hopefully a happy ending.
Right. Yeah, no, my husband played with Gino Vannelli for like a year and a half on tour.
Uh-huh.
And I've known some other cats that have, and it's been, they've, you know, they, if I were to interview them, they probably would. Gino would be included.
It was tough.
Yeah. Wow. So now the final question is, what is the scariest thing that has ever happened to you while playing live?
Oh, wow. Off the top of my head, I can think of two things. I was playing with the Yellow Jackets in Bratislava, Slovakia. Bratislava, Slovakia. And we were on stage, and it was a big auditorium, and something happened with the electricity.
Mm.
And the whole place went dark, and we were asked not to move.
Oh, wow.
So I thought, okay, what does that mean? Am I going to be electrocuted any minute now? And sure enough, this guy came up on stage with a big, giant, plumbing wrench,
mm-hmm.
went behind the curtain and started banging on something, and then all the electricity came back on.
Oh,
so from that point on, I was a little nervous about being on that stage.
Well, yeah.
And making sure I didn't grab like a mic stand and my bass
at the same time.
And just watched where I was walking. Because we heard a story that not long before we got there,
mm-hmm.
That John Abercrombie had saved the life of a Czech guitarist that did have his hand on his guitar, grabbed a mic stand,
mm-hmm.
and immediately was being electrocuted. Wow. And John Abercrombie happened to be on stage, and he saw that, and he actually punched the guy off of the mic stand
and
saved his life.
Wow.
Because, he was froze.
Yeah, because that's what happens. You know, just like it's in the movies. It's just like that.
Just go,
yeah. right.
And you're toast.
Well,
So there's that, and then the only other time was I was playing with Bruce Hornsby at a concert, and he invited the audience on stage.
No way, really?
And that was a little freaky, because all of a sudden there was like, you know, a thousand people on stage dancing,
okay,
but you don't know what's going on.
Right.
We're trying to play
keep
the tune.
Playing. Did anybody try to get to your mic? And, or
well,
mic
you know,
and
people were
singing.
Grabbing my arm, and
yes.
I stood
God.
Way, way back,
yeah.
almost behind my amplifier. And I looked over at the drummer like, this
like,
is crazy. But it was all in fun, and everybody was having a good time, so...
Yeah, but that must be, because it's like they, you know, once they invite, then everybody's rushing, you know, so you really don't know,
what's
at this
going
point,
on.
Yeah, what's going to happen. Yeah.
I actually had to push a few people out of
really?
The way.
Oh, wow.
They got to there, and they were like dancing and falling down. Maybe some people
wow.
were drunk. What,
drunk or
know.
Stone? Drunken stone. We
yeah.
would like
so they, you know, and I didn't want them to crush my bass or, you know, break the neck on it. Or,
yeah, because, you know, then you have
know.
To take it to a luthier who would have to then figure out what was wrong.
Out, how the hell do I fix this thing?
Well, I wanted to ask one more thing. If okay. you are going to give a person that is starting out or has already been doing music anything like a tip or a little bit of advice for them in, you know, just an attitude, whatever, what would you give them, you know, if somebody was just wanting
well,
to do this business? Or
I can only share what I experienced when I first started playing even trumpet, but even more so when I started playing electric bass when I was 13. And I was just, it was just awe-inspiring. It was a new thing that I'd never done before.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt like it was the coolest thing in the world to be able to learn a song and play it along
yeah.
with a record or play with other musicians.
Yeah.
So I've always tried to keep that feeling inside of me, when I, even now after playing 50 years.
Yeah.
And that is to just, you know, have respect for the other musicians and the music that you're playing, and always strive for feeling joyful and passionate about what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know? And I even bring it up to another level where I try to, you know, reach a very spiritual place in playing
mm-hmm.
music and digging deep down into, you know, the soul to
yeah.
find a really good place for the music, so that it means more than just a bunch of notes on a piece of paper.
Right.
So always try to have those feelings when you're playing or learning music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that'll keep everything really fresh and new.
Yeah.
And you'll always enjoy doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
You have to find that.
Yeah.
So look for that. And that's a key to having a longevity in
okay.
playing music, I think.
Wow. Wow. This has been so great. Like I said, we should have started 3 hours early so I could get a whole lot, because I have so many more questions. But thank you so much,
my pleasure,
Jimmy, for doing this, and for first of all coming out and you know, seeing Michael and
you
everybody.
You guys sounded great.
It was just so much. I mean, we had all the heavy hitters out there, you know, and I think probably Sean was like, "Oh, Jimmy Hassel's out there listening."
Oh, so. No. No problem.
But
it was great to meet him. I'd not met him before.
Oh, you didn't?
And, of course, I've known the horn player. I've met him
Oh,
times.
Carell.
Yeah, Carell. I met Carell years ago.
Really?
I met him in Europe.
Oh, wow. Because
yeah.
his father's like a keyboard player or piano player.
He came to a bunch of Jackets gigs when
wow.
we were in
oh,
Europe.
And
then
you.
Later he told us he was moving to New York. And we said, hey, that's a good move.
Yeah.
And
here seems, it is.
Yeah.
Right.
And also Willard. I've known yeah. Willard for a long time because he's friends with Will Kedeny.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So
yeah, that's
I met
yeah.
him through Will. And... yeah, Charles I've known
well,
for
of course,
a long time.
Yeah, you know. Blinzy. Who doesn't know Charles? You know, who doesn't know Charles?
It's all but, cool.
Yeah. So but anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been great. And that wraps it up for us on Tales from the Jazz Side.
The jazz side is always there, waiting for us to enter and waiting to enter us. So, until next time, unplug your ear holes, for you never know what worlds may be waiting for you.